I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal, and today our guest is David Hahn, a finance partner at Davis Polk & Wardwell in New York. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, David. Always good to speak with my namesake as well.
We're going to talk about several things on today's podcast. First, a little bit about your background and what it was like to start your practice in 2008 and the years thereafter, which were, of course, very challenging. The opportunities and challenges of moving firms a number of years into your career as you did, and what you're seeing in the finance markets currently. So with that, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, how you came to practice law.
Sure. First and foremost, I grew up in New York. I'm a Long Islander, born there, raised there, went to school upstate for undergrad, and then law school at Fordham. I currently live on Long Island today, and I have a wonderful wife and three young daughters, 5, 7, and 20. And I'm someone who began my career at a different firm, as you noted earlier, and then came over to Davis Polk later in my career, about 9 years into my career. I started at Cahill Gordon before that and did both debt finance and capital markets work over there. Got promoted to counsel at Cahill Gordon, then came over to Davis Polk in February of 2017. I'm also someone who comes from a family who really doesn't have any lawyers in the family. I'm the first lawyer in the extended family, and it's very much a family of blue collar backgrounds that I think I take with me every day as I approach my work. And it's that work ethic that allows me to be resilient and adaptable, and also inspires me, frankly, the things that my family have done to work hard, put food on the table, put their sons and daughters through college, and allow me to be in a position to go to law school is definitely something that I keep in mind when burning the midnight oil and working really hard.
And so you graduated from Fordham, from law school in 2008, and started practice just as the financial world was melting down. What was that like, and how did you manage those initial years of your career and what was a really challenging market generally, and certainly financing market?
It was certainly a difficult time. It was also a time of a lot of anxiety for people in my position. There were firms that were letting people go. There were firms that were deferring summers and first years. And I was fortunate to land where I did and to have really good mentors. My partner mentor over at Cahill, still practicing there, is Corey Wright. And Corey was helpful to me in making sure that I got a certain level of work to stay busy and continue learning and developing that year. And it was really a struggle, frankly, to stay busy enough to make sure that you were developing and felt like you were getting the opportunities that you needed to. You really had to look for them and seek them out, take initiative. And that was good for me in the sense of building up that drive to seek things out on your own and not necessarily rely on things coming to you. But I did also, as I mentioned, have the benefit of fantastic mentors who made sure to feed me good opportunities as well and ensured that I was benefiting from those. You know, when I started, it was right after Bear Stearns had gone under and before Lehman. And I actually recall sitting on a friend's couch, was working at Lehman Brothers at the time, on a Sunday while watching some football. And my friend got a call while we were sitting on his couch, instructing him that he should come into the office. This was a friend of his who was actually a superior, kind enough to give him a call and at least tell him he should come get his personal belongings. Because if he didn't come get them that day, the doors might be locked that evening upon a bankruptcy filing and he might not be able to get them. So it was certainly a wild time. It was challenging personally. It was challenging professionally. But I do think it changed my mindset and my mentality. It made me appreciate the opportunities that we do get, understand that there are market cycles like this and that these are learning opportunities too when they do come about. And also to, again, to be taking initiative in your career and be responsible, take ownership of your own career and the opportunities that you get, because they won't just naturally come to you all the time. So that's something that I found. And then I also got to work on some really interesting matters that at the time were new. I think folks who did mentor me and who I did work with were kind enough to take the time out to explain concepts to me and really teach. And that's something that also happens in these periods of reduced activity. I think you have an opportunity, if you seek it out, to get some informal training through teaching opportunities and being coached up by your superiors. And that's something that, you know, I didn't take lightly. And I appreciate the time that those folks spent with me, kind of walking me through the finer points of a deal and the process of a deal. It was a good time to get that down. But we did work on some really, really interesting things. And you know, one of those was the GMAC debt exchange, which was the biggest private debt exchange offer at the time. There were a lot of other exchange offers that occurred on the heels of that so that companies could delever borrowers that just had massive debt loads. And I think one of the other interesting things that I learned as an outcome of that was how the markets evolve after crashes like this, right? You know, we saw on the heels of that period, a shift in the way that deals were done. You know, at least private equity deals started to be done predominantly through designations, and that was new in the practice. And I got to experience that firsthand as a junior lawyer and see how those operate. And there were terms changes too, from things that folks had learned and come to understand in documents that, you know, popped up during the course of that crisis. One example is open market purchase provisions in debt agreements and borrowers wanting the ability to go out in credit deals and be able to make individual privately negotiated purchases of their own loans rather than relying on broad offers open to everyone, similar to the debt exchanges that we did. And I think those debt exchanges were critical to folks understanding that they might want some other options at their disposal if times get tough.
You mentioned the GMAC debt exchange offer in 2008. Were there deals in 2020, especially in the 3 or 4 months in the spring when things were really uncertain, that had an effect on you and allowed you maybe to rethink terms and practices that in more normal times, lawyers wouldn't reconsider?
Absolutely. One that stands out to me that made an impression on me is the LBO of iHeart Communications, which is formerly Clear Channel. At the time, it was Clear Channel Communications. And that's one that I stepped into right in the midst of the deal. It was fraught with a lot of contention. Parties were somewhat adverse to each other. They had signed up commitment papers, the banks for that acquisition, and were committed to fund it, but had balked after market terms changed and sought to find ways to maybe back out of it or renegotiate some of the terms because they were concerned, of course, that they'd be able to market the debt on those terms and thought that they might end up with a hung deal and end up with that debt on their balance sheet, which is not the goal in a syndicated deal. It's a distribution model. Banks, of course, want to be able to syndicate that debt to market participants like hedge funds and CLOs and mutual funds that buy that debt. So that deal was particularly interesting because of the contention around it and how hostile the parties were to each other. And there was litigation over it. And as a result of that deal, the practice changed in the sense that lender protective provisions started going into acquisition agreements. They're referred to today as Xerox provisions. I became intimately familiar with those. I actually did a training once I arrived over here at Davis Polk on Xerox provisions, and I can tie it directly back to my experiences on the Clear Channel LBO. But it also made me have a better understanding of exactly how the words on the page, again, as a very junior lawyer, truly do matter. And you have to understand when you're committing to something and when you're advising someone who's committing to something, precisely what they're signing up for. And in that instance, what the levers they could pull were if things go wrong. And it's really those opportunities to see how things play out when things are not going smoothly and when they go wrong, where you have the greatest opportunity, I think, to really learn and develop and to then refine your practice going forward and make adjustments in how you draft things, how you think about things, and how you advise your clients.
Have you seen any of those situations in the last 3 to 6 months, which themselves have been quite challenging in the finance markets?
Certainly. We've had a number of deals that Davis Polk worked on, and we've also seen other peer firms work on other deals that have gotten a lot of commentary in trade publications and news articles where the banks committed to, or I should say lenders, because some of these were private credit deals as well, where lenders committed to provide financing at point A in time. And there was a significant tail on the deal, right? The commitment tenor was long. Call it 12 months on some of these with extensions for regulatory approvals. So from the perspective of the lender, you're trying to peer into the future and understand if the terms you're negotiating will look fair and will be in a syndicated deal, terms that you can offload to the broader market, maybe 12, 15 months down the line. That's obviously really difficult. No one has a crystal ball. But we try to do a good job advising our clients of the things that we might foresee down the line and the typical protections that you would expect in those situations. And I think lenders are very careful when they're entering into those types of commitments as well. That being said, no one could have predicted the current uncertainty in the market when some of these deals were being signed up that were really, really large, meaningful LBOs where there was a lot of excitement about being involved in them. And lenders were eager to commit to them. So I'm thinking of deals like, you know, Citrix is one of them, that the recent Twitter financing is another. And there were a lot of unintended market headwinds that just made those deals incredibly challenging when it came time to close the acquisition and therefore show up with the debt financing. And in the instance of Citrix, at least, you know, we learned a lot through that troubled syndication about the way that people view the different, as I mentioned, levers that they can pull, you know, how flex provisions operate in a really difficult environment in ways maybe that are unexpected. You know, there were multiple counterparties in each of these deals because they were so large, and you had to get and build consensus. And that's difficult too in those times. And the financings were also very complicated, lots of different elements, the capital structure. So understanding the interplay between all of them and what the expectations were of the different participants and kind of marrying them up to reality was something that I think we learned a lot about during the course of those financings. And, you know, the other thing is there are elements of those financings that I think historically people have never expected to fund, like bridge loans that are meant to be taken out by a bond offering, or worst case, if you couldn't go do a bond offering in the market, there's securities demand provisions in fee letters that allow the banks to force issuers to go to market on a bond deal. And market conditions just didn't really provide the same level of protection with those features, given rising interest rates, inability to even sell demand securities if you demanded them anytime recently. So we've seen a lot of bridge loans fund. And I think some of the financings you are seeing right now that are occurring where regulated banks are entering into them are being structured, not as term loan Bs, for instance, that would be syndicated, but as term loan As. They're sold to institutional players, other regulated banks, with the hope that they'll eventually be taken out and replaced with a term loan B. Some cases, they're term loan Bs masked as a term loan A. And similarly, short-term instruments are being put into place, like bridge loans or things that are not quite a typical traditional bridge loan, but look like one, with the expectation that when times are better, they'll be taken out.
So the Hung Bridge goes as far back as the famous Sealy mattress burning bridge deal, which I believe was a buyout from the 80s. So what changes and what stays the same in these situations where lenders commit to a deal under one set of credit circumstances and then find themselves having to fund the deal in a very different set of circumstances? Do the papers change enough that the answers are different? Do you just have much more complicated capital structures now so that makes the resolution of these situations different? So what changes and what stays the same?
So what changes is partly dependent on what the actual documents say. There'll be market flex provisions that will allow the arrangers to say that certain provisions need to be changed based on the market conditions and the feedback they're getting from investors. So those are already drafted into the document and they're there, and everyone knows when they sign the papers precisely what those flex provisions are. Now, that doesn't mean that the papers can't change by agreement among the parties too. So if, for instance, on capital structure is underwritten that contemplates one set of facts, everyone's assumptions obviously change. The borrower can always enter into an amended set of papers with the banks based on what they're seeing at the time and change the capital structure. And that's something that did happen in some of these instances. There were changes that were mutually agreed that were not anticipated when the papers were signed, but it was based on the good judgment of very commercial parties as to what was necessary to get the deal done and to get it over the finish line, again, with a lot of different constituents who might not have the same interests. So, you know, some of these deals are interesting too, in the sense that the larger ones like that I mentioned, like Citrix, you have, you know, your syndicated banks who are in it. There were private credit lenders who had committed to provide big chunks of it and were buy and hold, right? They're not going to syndicate that debt out, but they had come in at the commitment paper stage and agreed to take a piece of it. And so you really do have people who just fundamentally think about things differently, right? The banks, their goal is to ultimately offload that debt. And the direct lenders had committed to buyouts on certain terms. And so changing a capital structure where maybe they're a buy and hold, it may not work for them, right? So ultimately, you have to come to some sort of an agreement that works for everybody, using a combination of both the provisions that everyone originally signed up. And if there's ways that those simply don't work or maybe don't contemplate the state of play when you're prepared to get closer to closing a deal, parties can just amend the papers and change the capital structure. Maybe a sponsor, a private equity sponsor in a particular circumstance, based on relationships, might even be willing to grant more flex. And they might actually document some of that. Other flex might be unwritten, but they might agree to do it in order to see the debt financing through. Because ultimately, the private equity sponsor as the buyer wants the debt financing to get done. It will see these players again in other deals that it does down the line. A lot of times the key relationship players are the ones that initially commit to provide these financings. And so there's not always an incentive to just stick people with the terms that they've signed up for. And parties tend to work together to try to find a solution. And the seller, of course, is also putting pressure. The seller of an asset is putting pressure on the private equity buyer to make sure that everything goes smoothly because they, of course, want their money.
You mentioned direct lenders several times. What are you seeing there? How has direct lending evolved in the last several years? And where do you see it going?
It's really evolved in a fascinating way. I think if you go back 5 years, even 10 years, there's been a number of things that have been just seismic shifts in the private credit market. One of them is just the sheer check sizes that an individual institution is able to commit to and able to cut ultimately. So we're in a world now, obviously, where given current market conditions, people are scaling back the check sizes that they might be willing to cut. Barring certain situations, there are outliers here and some of it's relationship based or opportunity based. But by and large, currently the direct lenders have cut back on that. And they've also instituted some concentration limits, maybe based on industry, based on sponsor. But if you step back from that and you look at before the market inflection point and where the market had developed to versus where it came from, like we said, 5-10 years ago, it's a striking difference. We're talking some institutions are able to cut up to $1 billion checks individually. They can fund a deal of that size on their own. And the private equity sponsor or corporate borrower, if it's a corporate borrower, does not need to seek out other financing sources. They can deal directly with one institution. Those are deals that used to have to be clubbed up with a variety of different institutions providing that financing. And then there's also just far more industry participants, and they're way more sophisticated, providing a broader range of products. There are private credit institutions today that have syndicated desks that can do a syndicated financing if the client comes to them and wants that. And that's something that didn't exist previously in years past. There's also been a specific initiative to develop revolving capabilities, revolving loan facilities, and some of the provisions that go along with them and the features that go along with them, such as letters of credit is another one, for instance. And that's something that previously, at least some direct lending institutions were unable to provide. And that left borrowers and sponsors having to search out other participants to bring into their deals to provide that piece of the capital structure. These days, they can find that solution with the private credit providers. So in my mind, those have been the biggest shifts. The traditional advantages and distinctions to direct lending as compared to a syndicated deal, you know, in terms of speed of execution, certainty of terms, you know, all of that remains true and hasn't really changed. It's more that I think the direct lenders have stepped up to compete on a broader platform with regulated banks and syndicated financings.
What else are you seeing in the finance markets now that's different or striking to you?
The other thing that I would say we're seeing, given the prolonged lull in the syndicated market, in addition to just direct lending being more likely than not the likely source of capital right now, if you're a borrower or private equity sponsor, the other things that we are seeing are a slight uptick in restructuring and distressed financings. It's not as dramatic as we might have expected if you ask folks to estimate where restructuring activity would be, say, 2-3 months ago. I think that could still come. It's not to suggest that there aren't clouds on the horizon, but I think it remains to be seen if that really picks up in a real dramatic fashion, or if maybe we return to more normal market conditions and new issuances start to pick up as well, including through the syndicated market. But the other thing that we've seen is an increase in liability management deals and interest in them. And I say interest in them for a variety of reasons. One is they tend to be the types of deals where there are winners and losers, and they're very clear winners and losers. And if you're on the non-participating lender side where you feel like you've been burned, there's strong feelings about them. So there's inevitably people who are unhappy with them who are very noisy about it. And I would also say that there's been a marketing effort behind liability management deals. Financial advisors and others, law firms are pitching them as a solution now. And I think borrowers previously would have been, in some instances, at least hesitant to engage in them, given there's not as long a track record of them being done, the prospect of unhappy partners, litigation, et cetera. But now that more of them have been done in the market and they're more well established and the rules of the road, so to speak, around what's acceptable in them, or at least what the common playbook is, have been more well established, we are starting to see more of those.
You mentioned that you moved law firms about 8 or 9 years into your career. Talk about the challenges of making that move at that point, but also the opportunities and how you manage them.
That was certainly something where I had the typical, I'm sure anyone who's been through a shift in a job knows this well. There's always, no matter how much preparation you do, some degree of feeling awkward and needing to get comfortable in a new setting. And I was very happy to come over to Davis Polk. It's the best career decision I could have made. It enabled me to become a partner at a law firm, which was always my goal, and to better myself and really expand the breadth of my practice, become more well-rounded, have a broader repertoire. But it was very, very challenging. And I think when I was coming over, I had this very rosy image of it, and I wasn't necessarily keeping in mind the challenges ahead that I was going to face in order to reach my end goal. And I had to learn to, I like to use the phrase, become comfortable being uncomfortable with things that were new to me, because this is a place that really pushed me to become the best version of myself by exposing me to new things. And it was hard at a senior level to step into things where I'm the most senior non-partner on a particular matter, say a debtor in possession financing or an investment grade deal or even a direct lending deal when those were new to me. And I've not really done them before. And I'm pitching myself as a counsel on a deal, but I didn't feel like I had the requisite knowledge. And I really had to learn to not allow myself to get bent out of shape over the things that I didn't know, because those were there and they were going to be present no matter what. They were out of my control. What was in my control was focusing on what I did know and taking the skills that I had developed and just applying them in a different setting. And I think if you can do that and just be persistent, you can overcome a lot of things. And I know I mentioned earlier my family background, and I think having a certain work ethic allowed me to be persistent in that way and to push through times where if I had kind of allowed myself to get too wrapped up in my own thoughts, I might have doubted myself. And I also had, as I mentioned, fantastic mentors at Cahill. I also had equally fantastic mentors here who took the time to walk me through the nuts and bolts of some of these things that were very new to me and make it so that I didn't feel like they were quite so novel and that I was put in a position to succeed. I do think that's one thing that is very special about Davis Polk is we really cherish ourselves on the professional development of our associates and counsel. We're all constantly learning from each other. That goes for the partners too. There are new things we all learn every day. And we try to put our people in positions to succeed and empower them. And so that's how I was able, I think, to get through some of those challenges. But the opportunities that were put in front of me were things that I just simply hadn't experienced before. And I was so excited about them. And I remain excited about them today, that I have such a well-rounded practice, that I get to do things that some peers and other firms just simply don't get to experience. I think it makes me a better credit lawyer to see when things do go south and you go through a bankruptcy. As we were talking about earlier, what does that mean for the drafting of documents? Where can things go wrong in a document? And I'm able to kind of adjust my approach, incorporate that into my practice, I think become a better attorney and a better partner and advisor to my clients, which that's the part of the practice that I enjoy the most, is feeling like I'm a partner in the trenches. I'm not just telling people what to market. I'm not just reciting what's in a document. I get to be creative. I get to come up with solutions, and I get to ultimately feel like I'm a valued partner.
Was there a specific point where you became comfortable when you were a little uncomfortable, or was that something you just grew into?
You do grow into it over time through enough reps of a specific type of deal. I do think it takes a few to be comfortable enough to the point where you have a certain level of proficiency that you continue to stack on top of that, of course, but where you don't have that sense anymore of a vast amount of things that you don't know, and you just start to shrink that. And it becomes less and less with each rep. But I would say you need a couple of different, or maybe 3, 4, 5 times through a specific type of deal, seeing it start to finish. And that's one of the other things. You don't always get to see it start to finish, right? So some of these chances you get to try a particular type of deal, it may wither on the vine, it may never come to a conclusion, it may go in a different direction. I think it's important to see it from start to finish. And for me, it did take just a certain amount of, as I mentioned, reps with a particular deal to get comfortable. I think also having the right mentality about it that we spoke about before helps expedite that a little bit. But there's only so much you can do, even with the right mindset and mentality. You just have to be willing to put your head down, be coachable, be adaptable, and also be receptive to some harsh facts that, you know, you have to be willing to look at yourself and be self-aware enough to really know where you need to improve and target that and put your energy into that. And that's something that can be hard to digest too, especially when you're very senior, you know, you've been practicing for a while, you feel like quite a lot of things that you're extremely skilled at, but being comfortable enough with yourself to recognize where you have areas for improvement, I think is something that can take you far too. And I focus on that every single day. I know that I'm not a finished product and I'm looking for ways where I can demonstrate not only to others, but also myself, continued growth.
And then finally, how do you decompress from work?
That's a great question. I'm more than happy to talk about that. I have a number of different ways. First and foremost for me is definitely spending time with family. I know I talked about earlier about having a wife and three young daughters. I really do value the time with them. One thing I've learned over the course of practicing has been the work can be tough. The hours can be long. It can be very demanding, but you have to have a really good support system at the end of the day to be able to function at your optimal level. And I'm blessed to have a really strong support system. And I try to focus more on the time that I do get with that support system than, you know, regretting the time that I don't. And I make it count when I'm there. I try to be present. So that's one thing. I also do try to work out. I like to run. I particularly like to get outside. I mean, frankly, even when it's freezing cold, you might see me running in a skull cap and gloves. I find it clears my head. It gives me a refreshed take on things when I get back to work. I feel energized. It allows me to sleep better. If you've been through a stressful day or you're angry or upset, it just kind of wipes that away. So I think that's key to being just mentally sound and in a good place mentally, which then allows you to really pour yourself into your work in the right way. And lastly, I have shows that I like to watch too. I like to read fiction, but sports for me is a great escape. I'm a big basketball fan. I watch a lot of Knicks games, but my favorite sport, the team that's nearest and dearest to my heart, is the Buffalo Bills. I've been through a lot of heartache with them, four Super Bowls that they didn't win. I was old enough to remember those at the time. My father's from Buffalo, so that's how I got into that. And it's really been just such a joy to see them go through those valleys and now be kind of at the peak again. And, you know, I'm hoping that at some point here in the near future, I'll get to witness them win a Super Bowl. Maybe I'll even get to go there in person, host some clients there or something like that. But I'm an absolute diehard Buffalo Bills fan, and I'm trying to get all my daughters to adopt them as well.
David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
For Drinks with a Deal, I'm David Marcus.